Coming up next on Tech News Today, Jonathan Strickland joins me once again. We're going to talk about Twitter's second screen experience and how it's about to get all political. Also, the Luke arm prosthetic, 10 years in the making, is about to see the light of day officially. Pokemon Go continues to be a thing, and we can't ignore it. We'll see how long that lasts. And finally, Amazon has plans to live in the trees, sort of. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1552, recorded Monday, July 11th, 2016. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/TNT. And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit Wealthfront.com/TNT and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's Wealthfront.com/TNT. And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TNT for 30% off your entire order. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about some of the biggest tech news stories with people who are passionate about technology. I'm Jason Howell. I avoided Pokemon pretty much all weekend, but I think it's kind of like part of my job, so now I have to do it. Joining me is someone who is at least maybe a little bit more familiar with Pokemon than I am, Jonathan Strickland from How Stuff Works. How's it going, Jonathan?
It's going well. I would say I'm only more familiar because so many of my friends are playing it that it is unavoidable.
You've already been exposed enough to kind of have, seeped in some of that knowledge from the periphery. I understand.
Yeah, I know that it's a game that involves some sort of digital replacement for dog fighting. And I don't know how I feel about it.
I really don't know how I feel about it either. But one thing I know is we're going to talk all about Pokemon Go a little bit later. When we get there, don't worry. I'll give you fair warning. If you really want to scan forward the next 5 to 10 minutes beyond that, feel free. But definitely, you know, come back because we've got other great stuff to talk about that doesn't involve Pokemon. And starting at the top of today's show, we do have stories that have nothing to do with Pokemon, although not very much because Pokemon really sucked the life out of tech news today. So let's start with Tesla. Tesla's under fire again in regards to the fatal accident last May that involved its autopilot technology. This time, the Securities and Exchange Commission in the U.S. is looking into whether the company should have disclosed the fatal crash to investors in a securities filing. A source told the Wall Street Journal that the question is whether the crash constituted a, quote, material event, that is, something an investor would consider to be important to their investment in Tesla, let's say. Tesla had previously stated that the crash did not require disclosure to investors. And I think the stock price actually performed pretty darn well immediately following the kind of news that when Tesla did put it out that this had happened. What do you think about this, Jonathan?
Yeah, this is an interesting story because it plays into not just the technology side, but then the regulatory side. Mm-hmm. The initial response I saw was that some people were saying because of the nature of the accident and because of the fact that it involved a feature that's supposed to increase the safety of the driver in a Tesla vehicle, that in fact it was something that Tesla should disclose. Tesla representative said, hey, automakers aren't expected to focus on every accident. If they did, you would never have a shareholder meeting because there's so many accidents involving so many different makes and models of cars. And that's a valid point. And you could also say that Tesla's stance the entire time is that autopilot is a driver assist system. It's not an autonomous vehicle. It's not meant to be an autonomous vehicle. Therefore, this is not really that unusual compared to other high-end cars that also have driver assist systems. So if it's not material in those other cases, why would it be material in this one? I think there's some validity to that, but the timing is just so unfortunate.
Yeah, it really is. So you take a look at the timeline, right? The crash happened May 7th. Tesla learned of it, didn't know all the details. So I think at that point, I mean, maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but the public knowledge is that they didn't actually know, you know, there was enough damage, enough destruction that they didn't actually know how much of an involvement the autopilot was at that point. They notified auto safety regulators May 16th. Turns out Elon Musk, sold 2.8 million shares of Tesla on May 18th. And that was related to tax requirements. So this is where you kind of get to that point where it's like, the timing of this stuff, like that could be perceived as something. Ultimately, it seems like it probably isn't, but that's what they're investigating. Investigators sent on May 18th, so, you know, same day, or rather Tesla sent investigators to the scene to really do their full analysis of what had happened there on the same day that Musk sold those shares. And at the end of the month of May, completed the investigation, and the financing round had kind of already taken place by then. So the timing of things, it's all kind of confused and close and easy to kind of look at it and think that maybe there's, you know, some sort of something going on here. But then when you look at just how the stocks performed, right? Like if this is all about investor thoughts into this scenario and whether, you know, they are concerned, obviously they were not. Stocks rose 2% after the disclosure, the day after the disclosure. So stockholders seem to be okay with it. And it seems to be the case that they are saying, you know, by that they're all right.
Yeah, again, with that timing, it's so odd. You had the stock offering raised about somewhere like a $1.4 billion or more, and that was in the middle of May, and this didn't become public knowledge till the end of June. So it's natural that questions are rising up. And in fact, I also am just curious why hold on to the disclosure for that long, for not just all of May, but almost all of June as well. I mean, clearly having as many of the details as possible is important. And obviously there's a need to treat it with the gravity it deserves. I mean, a man lost his life in this accident, but it's still like it hits all the marks for making someone think that there's a little hinkiness going on.
Mm-hmm. Yet the public doesn't seem, or at least the shareholders don't seem to mind. So
Right. That's
probably what it's all going to fall back on. It's like, well, they didn't really seem to care unless they discover something. Whatever word you said.
Hinky.
Hinky.
Yeah.
Okay. Unless they discover something really hinky, then there you go. Speaking of discovering things that are really hinky, that might be the title today. I'm not sure. Uber is currently enduring a number of investigations and lawsuits. One in particular is a class action lawsuit that charged Uber with violating antitrust laws with coordinated surge pricing. That's kind of where it began. That was the beginning of something pretty eye-opening, it turns out, as Uber emails revealed a coordinated effort within the company to investigate opposing lawyers on the case. Uber basically hired private investigation firms, including ex-members of the CIA, to dig up dirt, go so far as to use encrypted chat services like Wickr to, quote, avoid potential discovery issues, end quote. The string of actions has the presiding judge ruling the evidence has a reasonable basis to suspect the perpetration of fraud for Uber. And this does not look good. I mean, Uber does not have a very great history, you know, a clean history, let's say, when it comes to controversial stories. There were stories a while ago about Uber kind of looking into journalists who were posting articles that were critical of Uber and like investigating their private lives, their families, to dig up dirt there. They're really into this whole digging up dirt sort of thing.
Yeah, you look over the history of Uber and it seems like it's all espionage and sabotage, right? Like there were also the stories way back when of Uber versus Lyft of drivers calling and then canceling pickups so that they could keep the other drivers busy while they managed to get a lot more of the fares. I mean, this is, I think when we write the chapter of ride sharing history, it's going to be like a spy novel. It is so weird. Also, I want to point out, they got former NSA and CIA folks to work on this in order to try and avoid detection, and they were caught. So don't hire those people.
That is a really good point. Yes, and we know who those people are, at least according to the article on The Verge. Ergo, they're a corporate research firm They were the ones that were contracted by Uber to investigate the plaintiff. Experts say that commissioning an investigation is pretty shaky ground as far as this is concerned. Those people interviewed for the investigation could actually eventually become witnesses in the case. So Uber takes a risk in doing in even doing that to begin with. And really just ended up taking what began as an antitrust case and turned it into this kind of side case along with it about how far Uber is willing to go to protect itself, which leads me to the main question that I have, which is, and I'm not saying it's right, I'm not saying it's wrong what they're doing, but I have a hard time believing that other businesses don't do this to some degree. It's just this time Uber, you know, has kind of been caught in the act. What do you think?
Possibly. This is something that gets so shady so quickly that it actually kind of surprised me. I mean, I'm sure that every major business is involved in some way in trying to keep as close tabs on opposition, whether that's a competitor in the marketplace or possibly someone who would be pursuing litigation against the company. But to this extent, it seems pretty drastic to me. And maybe I'm just naive. It could just very well be that I am not privy to the massive dark underbelly of corporate America.
I mean, and that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't understand necessarily behind the scenes how these large enterprises work to protect themselves. What are the lengths that they are willing to go to protect themselves? Definitely, when I read through this and when I read through the entire article and saw the lengths that Uber was willing to go as per, you know, the emails that they were given and all that kind of stuff, it seems very shady, and it seems like they went to great lengths and they knew about what they were doing was, you know, they definitely did not want people to find out. But I feel like a certain part of running a business that's a large target is also protecting yourself. And I'm sure, at least to some degree, these large corporations do this. I just don't know if they take it this far, and this seems pretty far.
Yeah, I think when the documentary film about Uber comes out sometime in the future, we're all going to be amazed. I mean, think about all the individual Uber stories that we have covered over the years. Everything from the safety of passengers, the whether or not the drivers were really should have been cleared to be Uber employees, to the CEO talking about eventually replacing all those drivers with robots. I mean, this sounds like a plot from a dystopian science fiction novel in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just keeps on happening. I'm sure we're going to get another chapter or maybe 10. Knowing Uber. Twitter has been integral to the to a large part anyways to this year's presidential election race here in the U.S. And it's about to get even more intertwined with a company announcing that it will be live streaming the Republican and Democratic national conventions. It's the same system. They'll be using the same system that we saw used for last week's Wimbledon coverage and that is going to be used for the NFL's upcoming Thursday night games. That'll be streamed to Twitter later this year. In this case, CBS will be shooting the coverage and working with affiliate CBSN to push the live streaming online. Now, Jonathan, last time you were on, middle of last week, you and I discussed how cool this platform could be for things not related to sports ball. And here it is. What do you think?
I was hoping for Game of Thrones. Although, depending on your view of this year's election cycle, maybe it is.
Kind of seems that way.
I think it's useful. I think it's useful for people to have a dialogue. I think Twitter actually can be a little more useful than other platforms like Facebook, where you are more likely to have a group of friends who probably share more of your same philosophies, where it just becomes kind of an echo chamber. I mean, it's very rare that I have people in my friends group who share radically different perspectives than I do. But on Twitter, it's more of a free-for-all. Mm-hmm. And so it may be that with that approach, you might be able to see some more interesting dialogue going on. I think more likely you're going to see a lot of jokes because that's what a lot of people go to Twitter to do. I know I do it, but that can still be at least a way for you to process information apart from just watching the proceedings of the national conventions.
So often when these things are happening, like I'm here at work, I'm working, you know, on a show, so I'm not necessarily, and I'm not in front of a TV, you know, this can, you know, that like a cable subscription that's in front of me. I'm online, so it's difficult for me to actually watch the events. And so I end up kind of checking them out through Twitter. And so I'm very curious to see how that interplay happens. I mean, a lot of times what you end up seeing on Twitter during these things are requotes of what you just saw. So it'll be, I think it's going to be an interesting experience to actually be able to watch exactly what's happening and to see at that that moment the points that people really kind of glom onto and kind of echo out into the distance altogether to really kind of accentuate the things that are that the majority of people that are, at least that are tuned in on Twitter, find important. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too.
No Twitter account will be required to watch, and you'll be able to get it on the web and mobile app. So Twitter says they're going to make it very available and very easy to find. So look forward to that. Not too much longer. I'm not sure exactly when those conventions start, but pretty soon, within the next couple of months. Coming up, how on earth can we not talk about something that appears to be a cultural movement in the making? But first, let's take a minute to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They are the sponsor of this episode. If you've ever been through the process of securing a mortgage for that house you love, then you know how challenging it can be. We did this 2 years ago. And though we have, you know, what we have is terrific and the guy helped us through the process, there was no getting around the complexity of it all. Just so much paperwork, so many missed details. If you weren't careful and you do not want to miss those details, well, Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century. It's fast, powerful, and completely online. Rocket Mortgage has taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. If you hate searching through stacks of old files and paperwork, which I know that I do, with Rocket Mortgage, you can kind of take care of it easily. You share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button, and you'll get help getting approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored to your unique financial situation. And what's even better, with Rocket Mortgage, you can do all of this on your phone or your tablet. It's a quick online process that you can manage from the convenience of your couch. And you should definitely check it out. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. If you're looking to refinance your mortgage or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/TNT. That's quickenloans.com/TNT, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. All right, so this is the point of the show where I told you guys we were going to talk about it. We gave Pokemon Go a small little place in last Friday's episode with Samus Govich, and apparently that wasn't enough, because the game is taking off right now, essentially, to put it lightly. And joining us to talk about it again, actually, is Sam Iskovich from Ars Technica, because a lot happened this weekend. How you doing, Sam?
Hello, hello, everyone. I come bearing an important app that appears to be sweeping the world.
Appears to be. It, like, sucked up all the tech news out of the sphere. There's hardly anything else to talk about because everybody is writing articles about Pokemon Go.
Well, there's a lot to be said, as you've noticed. I mean, gosh, where do we even begin? I've been committing crimes. I've been finding dead bodies. I've been breaking into old men's homes. It's a fruitful Pokemon Go world for me.
So, okay. So I've even read headlines like Pokemon Go is already changing lives. Tell us, is Pokemon Go changing your life?
What's funny is it was about a week before it actually came out that I said, no one is going to play this thing.
Yeah.
It's not, it to me, there wasn't very much in the way of actual gameplay to it. I'm looking down to remind myself of how boring it is. No, there was a closed NDA stricken period for fans. It wasn't even for press. And I snuck on. They didn't check my name or credentials, even though my last name, as you can see right there, is very easy to Google. And I just found it wasn't very interactive or interesting. But what's changed is that they've unleashed it on the world and made it free. It's very high profile just by default. Nintendo doesn't have much in the way of smartphone apps. Miitomo did quite well, but Miitomo didn't have this sort of real life, everyone's going to be doing this in geolocation ways together. Mm-hmm. So it's that name cache of Nintendo, that geolocation. I've started calling it a combination of a Fitbit and a slot machine. Pokemon Go really hits the endorphins in those two big ways of getting you out and walking you around, having you walk around in the real world and rewarding you for that. And then also just giving you Pokemon. Just here you go. Tap the screen a few times. You've got a Charmander. Do it again. You've got a Pidgey. It just throws crap at you for free very easily. It's not that challenging. There's not much of a game to it. So there's that social aspect as well that has really crept up, where everyone feels like they have the secret app, where everybody on the streets of Seattle all weekend, I saw a dude run into a sign while he was catching a Pokemon. I mean, it's the end of the world,
pretty much,
as far as I'm concerned.
Pretty much it's just groups all together. They're together, but they're all doing this.
Or they're also, they know, they look on the map. Oh, there's a creature a certain distance away. Yeah. I'll be right back.
Let's go.
And then the next person will, like, you know, it's like a bathroom break, but, for, you know, Charmander.
Pretty much.
Speaking of bathroom breaks, I was telling Jason before the show.
Great
here,
segue.
Here in my office building, the office I work in, HowStuffWorks.com, shares a floor with MailChimp and Twitter. And I can't go to the bathroom without wading through people trying to catch your Pokemon.
It's just the way it goes. This is life. This is life in the future. We're just living in it. Thanks so much, Niantic. There's definitely a big difference right here between this and what Ingress was, let's say. Ingress and Pokemon Go share a lot of the same mechanics. Pokemon Go largely was built on the experience and the the experience and gameplay that Ingress was developed around. But it's got that familiar brand behind it.
Right, absolutely. These augmented gaming apps have existed for some time, and they've all been mostly about people using very boring systems. They're not very recognizable. It's these sort of grids and dots, and you've won nodes. It's all very sci-fi. It's all been very abstract. And this is just really the perfect branding combination, because people, to grab an app, love a character. I mean, this is what Nintendo's done for years, is take a game idea that's kind of new and slap familiar characters on it. Gosh, that's Mario Kart wouldn't have been nearly as big, in my opinion, if it had just been silly stick figure cart. Mm-hmm. Things like that. So it's not surprising to see something like this latch on, because it gives people something to hunt for. If they'd done this, if Jurassic Park had done this and everyone had been chasing velociraptors, it might have done just as well. Who knows what the ultimate brand would be, but definitely having that get around in the world, because there's going to be different stuff in different parts of the world, in lakes compared to in forests, compared to cities and so on. It's a good branding combination. But as you've noticed, some weird stories have been coming up as a result.
Yeah. So exactly what's happened here. This is the first time that I've heard of a game launching, and over the course of a single weekend since it launched, like, really bizarre things happening. Tell us about a few.
Absolutely.
Of those.
I think because augmented gaming and everybody crowding around in real meat space to get stuff in a game and having GPS check on you, you know, this is, got it. We haven't seen anything like this since Foursquare. But what the app does in Pokemon Go is it throws out these Pokestops where you can go and get items. You can pay to get stuff in the game, or you can go to these stops. They give you experience points, they give you items, and you can, as a human, pay a little money if you haven't earned the item to sweeten a Pokestop, so that little, when someone else is on their app, they can see little rose petals fluttering out. So there was a police station, I want to say in Missouri, I blank on the city name, but it was a police station in Missouri, put out an alert that 8 to 9 victims had been assaulted or at least threatened with a gun because they'd gone to a Pokestop that had been sweetened by the robbers. People show up. It's, you know, nighttime. There's not that much lighting. It's just a nondescript location that happened to have been marked on the map in that Missouri area as a Pokestop. Guy goes up. You need to be within an average of 40 meters, give or take. Sometimes that can be as little as 10 to 20. Sometimes that can be a lot further based on your device. This, by the way, is not the van that was found on the scene. I just photoshopped that very crappily. But yeah, people would go to these spots because the map said there's better stuff right here, and they just walk up, do-do-do-do-do, and then get mugged. And I think these sorts of things are going to happen more and more this is a kind of gameplay that nobody's done. So the idea of best practices with a thing like Pokemon Go, we have to make those up as we go. I think there is some common sense to think twice before going to a dark location. and getting your items. But there is, like I said, that little mental stimulation of the mix of Fitbit and slot machine makes people walk to get a free thing that means nothing. So that was, I think, the most intense story. I know there was another one about a man whose house was near a church, and that church got marked as a Pokestop. And so people just started showing up and loitering, just crowds of people. And he just reached out to a website, and they're like, we'll write this up because Pokemon Go's new. And I imagine because all this data is taken from the prior app that wasn't nearly as popular, that's now attracting a ton of people to certain stops. I know when I walked home last night, there were so many places that were just people's houses that were marked because of a sign or because of a bus stop or some sort of thing that the prior that Ingress's players had marked as, oh, this is cool. And so now there's a lot more people paying attention and walking up to them and claiming the stuff and standing around for a minute and waiting for the reception to come back. It's just creating a very weird social scene with that story in particular.
Jonathan, what about longevity? I feel like so often, and it's not a game, obviously, but Peach as a social network is the only example I can think of right off the top of my head, where like it came out, everybody was so on board, and it really only lasted a week, and then it fizzled out and died. Now, granted, Peach is very different. Peach is not Pokemon, but do you think Pokemon Go as a game has the longevity to keep this momentum? Or, I mean, at some point, it has to die off, right?
Yeah, well, I think there are a couple of things at play here. One, you're going to see some of the diehard fans, they'll hang on to it the longest, right? They'll be the ones who really do feel they gotta catch them all, and they'll want to try and get every single variant of Pokemon that there are, and then go through all the evolutions, and that's going to take a lot of time. But like what Sam was saying earlier, the gameplay elements of this app are pretty limited. There's not a whole lot to it. There needs to be a lot more functionality built into the game. A lot more actual game needs to go into the game for it to have retention, I think. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're going to see people who say, well, this is kind of fun and all, but it's really not that different from when Google did that April Fool's joke a couple of years ago in Google Maps. And you just wandered around Google Maps and collected Pokemon that way. This is just a little bit beyond that, where you actually have to physically go to different locations.
Right.
But you can argue that there's not much more of a game there than what was in that April Fool's joke.
Sure. I think the biggest thing is that there's very limited social matter to this. You in real meat space are like, oh, other people are playing this. That is interesting. That's a conversation starter. People are finding themselves strangely united by their desire to catch Pikachu. However, the game doesn't have really good social systems beyond, oh, if I use this item, I can attract people to my spot. You're essentially, the game rewards you for time. The more you play it, the more stuff you get. The more you tap it, the more stuff you get. But it's not, and that's it. It's time investment. It's just making the time to tap, as opposed to learning the systems, becoming a better Pokemon trainer, understanding the differences between water and fire and electric and all these sorts of things, and creating teams and battling. Nintendo and Niantic have said that there's more to come, and that is going to be necessary if people are going to socially engage. Pokemon makes sense for this because it was built with the link cable in mind back when the original Game Boy. I think it was not even Game Boy Color. It was the original Game Boy that ran the first Pokemon, and he needed the stupid link cable. And kids put up with this because it was so cool, because the game was built for this player-on-player battling. Goodness, if they get that working in this, if they actually build, but that would make it a legitimate Pokemon game. This is not that. And Nintendo's very careful about how its official games are launched. It's all tiptoeing into the smartphone world with something like this. The idea is that this is a tease, that if you really want the Pokemon experience, Nintendo would much rather you buy a 3DS or their new system or whatever the heck. Like, Nintendo really needs to make a full Pokemon game if they're going to get people to stay, if they're going to get people connected in a social way. Until then, people are going to run out of reasons to reach out to their friends. Friends are what keep you attached to a good app. Friends are what keep you attached to things like Twitter and Facebook and these sorts of things. Peached is actually similar to Pokemon Go in that if there's nobody there, no one's going to keep using it.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, speaking of Nintendo, they've had a pretty remarkable weekend. Saw this BuzzFeed article. Basically says Nintendo is worth $9 billion more today than it was last Wednesday as a result of this. I mean, That's just craziness.
Well, I mean, that's crazy, but that's also Nintendo has been tanking thanks to the Wii U.
Yeah.
Japan and consoles just aren't doing that well. People are not buying consoles in their home country the way they used to, and that has affected them on the Nikkei. I think that's how you say that stock market. Like, that has really impacted their Japanese performance on the stock market. And so the NX has only been teased and teased and teased. That saw a drop as well when they had to announce a delay of sorts and to announce a delay to the new Zelda. Nintendo just hasn't had a big show of force of saying that they are of cultural import. Miitomo, to some extent, helped a little bit. But Pokemon Go just being in everybody's hands, and people are paying. They're paying. Nintendo has eyeballs now. The problem is going to be when, not if, that population drop-off comes. So if for any reason Niantic has these, you know, battle systems and these other things ready to rock in the next 3 weeks, they better get them out, because this is Nintendo has other smartphone plans, and I think that's something that investors are looking at, that there's Fire Emblem and Animal Crossing. Those are popular Nintendo franchises that are coming to smartphone, and this, I think, is a good showing that those apps will probably be relatively as downloaded, maybe not just as much. But it's a good sign. People are hungry, clearly, for Nintendo stuff on smartphones. So their future as a smartphone game maker is definitely a reason to evaluate pretty highly. Now, whether Pokemon Go can sustain that for the next 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, we will have to wait and see. But good for anybody who bought into Nintendo stock a week ago.
Yeah, no kidding, to say the least. And then finally, iOS users, there's been a kind of thing that's been bubbling today about how, you know, if you sign up to use Pokemon Go on your iOS device, you're essentially handing over the keys to your Google account for the most part, at least all the information in your email and yada, yada. When you sign up, what exactly is this all about and how do you undo this?
So, yeah, with iOS, if you want to use Pokemon Go, you have two options. This is the same on Android as well. You can either sign in with your Google account, because Niantic was part of Google and therefore has a lot of that locked in place, or you can sign in with your Pokemon Trainer account, which you currently can't really do because Nintendo and Pokemon servers have been slammed by millions of people wanting to play. So The Google login, for whatever reason, is working just fine. However, when you give those credentials over, you essentially have to say, hey, I want to sign in with Google, and Google says, ooh, this is what we want to access. And you go, oh, okay. And you click okay. Well, it turns out when you're clicking okay, you're giving full access. Niantic could have been a lot more granular and said, we need your location data for the mapping part, and we need access to mobile data, some of the simpler things. And in fact, the Android version does that. However, by giving just the full run of all of your Google account, every single thing you do through your Google account, the ability to send and receive emails can be done, viewing and deleting your Google Drive documents, all the things that you would, oh, and your contact, your full contact lens, all the things that Pokemon Go does not need to operate, Niantic has asked for permission to take. And Niantic may very well come out and say, oh, well, we, you know, aren't going to actually use all that stuff. Currently, all Niantic is saying is no comment to share at the moment. That's what they said to us at Ars Technica.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, do no evil sounds great, but having access to all that data means that they could do anything they want with it, because you as a user have legally said, sure, go ahead, do anything you want with my Google account and all of the services attached to it. And the fact that Niantic has been asked about this and is not responding with anything weird, major, with any assurances, that is very strange. And who knows what that means? The Android app is not requesting those specific permissions. So I really doubt that they're really using that information in a very upfront or bold or terrible way. But the idea that they could have just hit a couple checkboxes and didn't. Sloppy move on Niantic's part.
Yeah, it could mar a launch, although it's not keeping a lot of people from installing. But you can refute those permissions after the fact. If you go to your security settings in your Google console, there's a connected apps and sites setting, and you can go in there, find Pokemon Go release, and remove it. And apparently, even doing so, you're still able to play the game. So,
well, thank God.
At least there's that. By the way, I just caught another. Registered my Pokedex. What is this? I don't know, but it's that. See, he knows.
This is riveting television right here.
Yeah, this is what happens. This is what happens when Pokemon Go is a thing.
I mean, if we were just doing it on my end, it would just be a lot of loading screens because Niantic servers are just getting pounded. So good on you for actually logging in. Not the same over here in Seattle. So maybe I can catch a few of them, if not all of them, after by the time I talk to you guys next.
All right. Sounds good. Sam Moscovich from Ars Technica, thanks for coming on and talking Pokemon once again. I think we're going to give Pokemon Go a break for the rest of the week, I think.
Yes. We'll talk in 3 weeks, and we'll see if I've connected it to my Elo account or anything like
yes,
that.
Yes. Perfect. Good day, guys. Perfect. All right. Have a good night. All right. I'm going to set Pokemon down. I'm not going to play. I promise. Not until the end of the show. We talked about a lot of very challenging stuff last week surrounding the violence in the U.S. Grant Johnson wrote in regarding the streamed video of the aftermath of Philando Castile's shooting by a police officer and the subsequent disappearance of that video from Facebook Live. That's what the email is about. Grant says, this made me think back a few days to the special infrared emitter to stop people from recording concerts. As annoying as the phones up at the concerts happens to be, a way to remotely disable all of the cameras in the area seems like a very bad idea from a freedom of information point of view. If I were corrupt and a public official or business, wouldn't it be easy enough to just put up a beacon and prevent gathering of evidence of my crimes? This, of course, I was not in when Megan was discussing this story, but I guess it was a patent. It was an Apple patent that would allow, concert, the venue essentially to shoot this infrared beam, and it would work with iOS devices to basically shut them down so that they couldn't interfere with a concert. I don't know how you blanket the entire country with something like this. What do you think, Jonathan? That sounds like a tall order.
How you blanket just a localized area with this? I mean, with the concert, it makes sense in the sense that you've got a place that everyone's focus is directed toward, and it's all unidirectional for the most part, unless you're talking about like a show in the round. So you just put one emitter facing out toward the audience. You don't need one pointing in every single direction. If you're talking about an event that's happening in the public and it's a spontaneous event,
right,
how do you create an emitter that's going to emit infrared in all directions? Also, that patent is about incorporating a system within iPhones. So in other words, it's a system that relies upon the device as well. It's not like there's some magical thing about infrared that will block a camera from working.
Right.
It's essentially sending a signal to your camera. It's kind of like image recognition software. If your camera doesn't have image recognition software, it doesn't matter what you point it at. It's not going to recognize what that is or change the experience in any way. And also, ultimately, even if this were completely enacted, I imagine what you would see is a bunch of people coming out with aftermarket infrared cutoff filters.
Right.
And all that would be is just a little filter you could put on top of your lens that would block infrared signals from coming through to the lens, meaning that your phone never sees infrared. So it doesn't matter what gets emitted at it. So this is not a I would not worry too much about this being a technology that gets rolled out in a wide fashion in order to silence people. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, and if it were to happen, it would probably be evolved to something that would be a little bit less easy to do, that doesn't have as much of an analog hole like what you're talking about, just slap on the filter and, hey, the problem goes away. It would take a lot of coordination also. If this is just iPhone, you would think that they would also need to kind of work this into all of the other manufacturers, all the other device operating systems and everything. That's a pretty tall order. Although I suppose I don't put anything past anyone who has enough of a will to pull something like this off, but it seems unlikely, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Up next, we'll take a look at how much prosthetic development is accelerating right now. So much so that DARPA has pitched in to develop an arm modeled after Luke Skywalker's prosthetic, and that's not a joke. We're going to take a look at that. But first, let's take a minute to thank Wealthfront, the sponsor of this episode. You invest your money for the long term, for your family, for your financial health, but trying to do it yourself, especially the right way, that's what's so complicated. It's time consuming. It's not easy. Luckily, there's Wealthfront. Traditional advisors charge huge fees, between 1% to 3% of what they manage. With Wealthfront, you pay 0.25% a year. That's 25 basis points, zero commissions, no hidden fees. That's less than $5 a month to invest a $30,000 account. There are no additional charges for any of Wealthfront's services. You can get started investing today with as little as $500. Now, unlike financial advisors, Wealthfront won't bog you down with, you know, tons of questions. They've simplified their risk identification process. That allows you to begin investing sooner. That's super important. It only takes a few minutes to sign up at Wealthfront.com. It goes right to work, starts monitoring your portfolios around the clock, takes action as soon as an opportunity arises. Wealthfront portfolios are based on modern portfolio theory, and they're designed to adjust according to your personal risk tolerance while staying diversified and tax efficient. Wealthfront is transparent. It's accessible. You can view and track all your accounts in one place. Wealthfront can track both your Wealthfront and non-Wealthfront bank and brokerage accounts that they'll provide in a summary to you of all your assets. You can see every trade that Wealthfront makes on your behalf in your dashboard on your desktop or with their mobile app. Wealthfront recently introduced their 529 college savings plan, allowing you to invest after-tax dollars, much like a Roth IRA, and save for your child or grandchild's higher education expenses. Wealthfront manages almost $3 billion in client assets and is growing rapidly every day. So what are you waiting for? Check it out for yourself. Invest in your future today with Wealthfront. Visit Wealthfront.com/TNT to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. You'll see the customized allocation that they recommend for your profile. And just for Twit listeners, if you sign up to invest, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 entirely free of charge for life. Join the many Twit fans who've seen huge success with Wealthfront and claim your offer today. Just go to Wealthfront.com/TNT. All right, let's chat a bit about the world of prosthetics, because as with everything these days, I'm constantly reminded that we are already living in the quote-unquote future. I figured this was so far off in the distance when I was a kid, but Jonathan, you followed a project that at this point is 10 years in the making. It looks like it's about to see the light of day. Tell us a little bit about the Luke arm prosthetic.
Yeah, this is something I've been following almost the entire time this has been a story. So back in 2005, 2006, the Department of Defense approached Dean Kamen, better known as the guy who invented the Segway, as well as tons of other stuff. And they said that they were looking into trying to develop a robotic prosthetic for arms to better give people who have lost an arm, specifically the military, people in the military who have lost an arm in the process of serving in the military, so to regain some of their mobility and their independence, be able to do things that most of us take for granted. And they gave Dean Kamen some very specific parameters, saying that they wanted this to be no heavier than the average human arm. So that's already a big, a big ticket thing. They wanted it to be able to differentiate the amount of pressure that you use to grip something. They wanted it to be have as many degrees of freedom as you possibly could get to equate that of a human arm, which is also pretty tricky. And Dean Kamen's response at first was, "You're crazy. This can't be done." But eventually he ended up taking on the responsibility, the actual project, and it went with DECA. That's Dean Kamen's company that he founded, funded by DARPA. This project was funded by DARPA to the tune of like $40 million, a huge investment on this. The robot arm, if you look at videos from about 2007, 2008, it looks pretty bare bones, terrible pun, I guess, but it is a very primitive looking machine that can do some amazing stuff. The current implementation is even more impressive in my mind. It looks really sleek. It has all of these abilities that people were hoping for when the project was first pitched. And the FDA approved it for use back in 2014. Now we're seeing DECA talk about this actually coming to market by the end of this year.
Wow. And I found it interesting how this in particular kind of translates those control signals. Tell us a little bit about how kind of those muscle movements are interpreted on this.
Electromyogram sensors!
What?
Oh, EMG sensors. Okay, so, you know, our muscles, actually our bodies very much depend upon electrochemical communication. and you get these little electric fields and electric signals that are sent to make your muscles do things. Also, you know, if you ever come into contact with electricity, your muscles will do stuff you didn't intend it to.
That's true.
Well, EMG sensors, you put them on the skin and they can detect minute amounts of electricity that are going on in muscle commands. So what you do is you have someone who has lost part or an entire arm. It's really, it's above the elbow for the Luke arm, which is different than from some other bionic hands that are out there. And you attach sensors to the part of the arm that's still there or to the shoulder, and you train the arm by having the person wearing it practice moving certain muscles in what they have left. That becomes a command. It's sent to a processor in the arm, essentially a small computer. And the computer is trained that when you do a certain muscle movement, it means open the hand, close the hand, rotate the wrist. On top of that, they actually have a secondary command system. It's some sensors or some actuators, really, that are put into your shoes. And you use that in order to increase the number of features you can use, you can do with the arm. Because if you just relied on whatever muscle signals you could send, you would have a functional but limited arm. And Deco really wanted to make sure that this could do pretty much the full range of motion that a human arm could do. In order to do that, they built in these switches so that you would be able to switch between different grip positions. Stuff that we take for granted, like the fact if you want to put your forefinger and your thumb together, that's one thing. But if you want to make a fist, that's something else. If you want to try and pick up a small item, that's another thing. So that's a way that you can switch between the different modes, really.
Yeah, watching the video, you see it, you know, you see the arm used to pick up a grape, and it's, you know, no big deal, just picking up a grape, which would be very easy to overcompensate, let's say, with the hardware and squish it to pieces. But
And they even has sensors on the fingertips that detect pressure. And then you have little motors to give haptic feedback. It's kind of like the motor you have in a cell phone. It rumbles, and the intensity of that rumble increases as the grip pressure increases. So the person wearing the arm has an idea of how hard he or she is actually gripping this robotic hand.
That is so cool. Yeah. That's so cool. Have to imagine this is not an inexpensive endeavor. Do we have any ideas on pricing, or at least a range of pricing when it's going to come out?
The biggest guess I've seen, like the guesses I've seen have ranged to up to $100,000. On the low end, you're still talking several thousands of dollars, maybe $10,000 at the lowest of the low end. But I can't imagine that this technology would hit that much. That being said, I wonder how many iterations the Luke arm went through, considering how much technological advancement we've seen over the past decade. Keep in mind, this project's been in place for 10 years, and they had working arms they were showing off in 2007, 2008. So just looking at the progress in computer power and battery life, you got to think that that's had an impact on the design. And of course, the Luke arm's not the only one out there. There are also some other really high-tech arms. There's Johns Hopkins modular prosthetic limb. There's iLimb. There's a couple of others that are pretty much on par in some ways to what the Luke arm can do, but they use different methodologies. Some of them are only meant for people who have lost an arm below the elbow.
Right.
And it won't work anywhere. Like, if you've lost an arm above the elbow, then it wouldn't be applicable.
Sure.
So this is pretty science fiction-y stuff, and I love that they called it the Luke arm, being a Star Wars fan.
Pretty fantastic. So obviously pricing becomes prohibitive, and that's where 3D printed prosthetics come in. Tell us about the open source initiative called the Enable Community Foundation.
All right, this is also an amazing initiative. So it started off with a costumer who had created a piece for a steampunk outfit. It was a big hand that extended his hand. He has a regular, you know, just a normal human hand, and used it to make this big kind of skeletal monster kind of hand for a steampunk outfit, and later got contacted by some by a guy who had lost a finger and said, hey, do you think we could maybe develop something where I could actually have a finger to regain my ability to use my hands? In the process of working with him, they found a young boy in South Africa who was missing a hand, and they decided to develop a 3D printed hand for this boy. And over the process of lots of iterations, they were able to do this. Now, what's cool is that 3D printing allows you to try lots of stuff. And if it fails, it's no big deal. You go back to the design phase, you try something different, you print it again. So your prototyping speed is ramped up significantly compared to other types of manufacturing. These days, there are makers around the world who are all part of this initiative who can either print pre-planned hands that have already been designed so that they can then gift it to someone who's in need of it, or they can even work on trying to improve the basic design so that there are better hands in the future. And it's awesome. If you go to the website, they actually have tutorials done by kids to explain how to put a hand together after you've printed all the pieces. Like, children are showing you, like, this is where the finger joints click in, and you use this pen to hold it in place. And here's the tension that allows you to run a string from the back of the wrist to the each end of each finger, and that's what allows the grip to happen. Now, one thing to keep in mind is these 3D hands that are awesome are not really a replacement for a full prosthetic. They allow for very basic gripping ability, for light weights, like it can't be anything too terribly heavy. The finger strength just isn't there. But it suddenly creates a lot of opportunities for people who might otherwise just have to go without.
Yeah, and they're specialized in some cases. There's one that's on that site that that you were just showing, Josh, the Shays Viola Bow Holder. So actually, you know, like a prosthetic that is designed specifically for this purpose, so that, you know, someone who, you know, who could use this could actually play an instrument again. I love this stuff. It's basically open source effort to bring these. Now, is there any sort of quality control, like any sort of like how do you make it onto this page? You just create something, and because everything there looks like it's of a certain quality.
Yeah, I think really it just comes into someone works on a design and then tests it and then sees if it actually works. And if not, they have to go back to the drawing board, test it. And I think there's a certain amount of quality control in that stage where before it ever reaches the point where other people can download it and print it, it's been through a pretty extensive testing stage. The organization is also very careful to point out that anyone who's interested in getting one of these hands – they also should work very closely with a doctor to make certain that the fit is appropriate, that the hand is really going to meet the needs of that person, that's not going to be giving a sense of false hope or expectations that go beyond what it can actually do. Also, just to keep an eye on whether or not the person reacts to the 3D printed material. If you react to that plastic, if you're getting a rash or your skin's getting raw, then obviously you would need to address that as well. So I think mostly the quality control part comes in the research and development side. And then ultimately, the responsibility is on the person who is requesting the hand.
Sure. That is really cool. I love it. I love that this exists, and it's just kind of it illustrates the power of kind of the 3D printed era that we're only just kind of beginning to come into. That combined with like open source, such a cool combination, because you just, people fill the gaps, they find the things that need to be created and they make them, and they work together to make it good.
And if you think about it, like when the Luke arm started to become a project, that was back in the earliest days of prosumer 3D printers. I mean, you had a few like bleeding edge adopters who were working in 3D printers, but most people, I would venture to say, had never heard of 3D printing in 2006.
Right.
If you were outside the auto manufacturing industry, for example, or the aerospace industry, you might not have ever heard about it. And now it's something that you or I or any of your viewers could go out and buy a 3D printer of sufficient quality to make stuff like these hands. And that's It's incredible.
Yeah, super empowering. Love it. Or you could just go out and play Pokemon Go, which is what TNT's Fan of the Day did. Actually, Fan of the Day is Patrick Delahanty. Sure, he works here, so in a way he's paid to be a fan. But he also engages in Poke Combat, although I know that that's incorrect in this case. This is just throwing a Pokeball. It's illustrated here where he's got Krabby on the set of TNT from last week. Father Robert and I do not appear to be very amused in this picture. Honestly, I think we're just frightened that, you know, the game of Pokemon had busted out of the augmented reality world and actually appeared in real life in front of us on the table. Yes, that actually happened. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google Plus, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT and we will find it. Coming up, if you happen to work at Amazon, first, congratulations. And second, you might be living your work life up in the trees. Sort of. We'll talk about that. But first, let's take a minute to thank Tracker. They're the sponsor of this episode. With advancements in technology, we have all sorts of smart things, smart cars, smart phones, smart homes. Losing your possessions can make you feel less than smart. And Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past. You just put Tracker anywhere you have a little pocket. Attach it to something that's very important to you. I have it in my backpack. You can attach it to your keys. That way, you know, when you leave, when you are separated from that item, you're going to know about it. It's going to give you a little alert on your phone. It's perfect for backpack, I think. It just fits right into this pocket I never use. My backpack is protected if I ever leave it behind or whatever. There it is. I'm going to get notified. The coin-sized device locates misplaced keys, wallets, computers, even pets in seconds. The Tracker Bravo is constructed with an anodized aluminum for the thinnest and most durable tracking. You can pair Tracker to your iOS or Android device, attach it to anything with the key loop or the adhesive, and you'll find its precise location with the tap of a button. It's really that easy. You can customize two-way separation alerts. And that way you're going to receive notifications before you leave your item behind. And if you happen to lose your phone, you press the button on the tracker and then your phone rings. So it's, you know, in both directions, even when it's on silent, in fact. With over 1.5 million devices, Tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the world. So your lost item shows up on a map, even if it's miles away. If an item goes missing, the Tracker app records its last known location on a map. And then when another Tracker user comes within a 100-foot range of your lost item, you will receive a GPS update of where your item is now located. Your phone can track up to 10 devices at once. Tracker is enabled by Bluetooth low energy, so the battery actually lasts up to one full year. Water-resistant cases are also available for purchase and perfect for pet collars, so it can endure all the elements. You can even add a laser-engraved message to each Tracker Bravo, like return or pet information. Tracker recently introduced Tracker Atlas, which works with your Tracker Bravo or third-party Bluetooth tracker to pinpoint your items on a customizable floor plan of your home, so you can save time and energy in your life by simply asking Tracker Atlas where your item is, and you'll instantly get an answer. No need to search under the couch cushions or behind the cabinet or wherever it happens to be. It'll tell you. Go to thetracker.com and never lose your possessions again. Plus, just for our audience, if you enter promo code TNT, you're going to get 30% off your entire order. That's thetracker.com, promo code TNT for 30% off your entire Tracker order, and we thank Tracker for their support. So who hasn't thought to themselves, we'd be way more productive if we moved this corporate meeting up into our company-built treehouse? Seriously, we've all been there. So then, who could fault Amazon for taking that ages-old sentiment and doing something with it? Amazon is working on its new headquarters in downtown Seattle, and a part of the plan includes three transparent conjoined spheres with high-tech greenhouses inside. Their employees are going to find treehouses that function as meeting rooms, as well as a ginormous plant collection supported by Amazon's horticulture staff, because that exists. Amazon has a horticultural staff. Rooms lined with vines, an indoor creek, and surely a whole lot more. Is this going to make you more productive if you work at Amazon, Jonathan? What do you think?
You know, I did a recent episode of Forward Thinking's audio podcast in which we talked about how wooden skyscrapers may become a thing in the near future. Timber-based structures are back, baby. And part of the justification, at least as far as the stuff we saw, was that People cited that you feel more at ease in an environment that has a lot of wooden structures and surfaces in it. And this was backed up by a study that was incredibly tiny and done by someone who has a vested interest in selling timber. So I'm not entirely sure that's scientifically valid, but this sounds really cool.
Sounds really good. I was there with you. Actually, a lot of what I read in this New York Times piece kind of backs up your claims, basically saying that, you know, plants and all that kind of stuff where you're working, if they're within view, that can increase your productivity as much as 15% in some of the studies that they ran. Indoor plants, you know, also obviously increase oxygen in space, improve cognitive tasks. So I don't think it's outside of the realm of possibility. I think you might be on.
I think the science just hasn't been rigorous enough to back it up, but that doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means it's not truly scientifically supported yet.
I don't know how I feel, though, about a skyscraper made entirely out of wood. That just sounds... I don't know. I feel like it sounds unstable. Am I wrong?
If they manage to build it, you'll be able to go to London, and it'll be the second tallest building in the city.
Wow.
Made out of timber.
Nothing but timber all the way up.
Well, it's technically laminated boards that are produced in a way that's really cool, but that should probably wait for its own episode.
All right. We'll come back and talk about laminated boards another time. But as for this time, always so awesome getting you on. Jonathan Strickland from HowStuffWorks.com. Tell people you're doing forward thinking. You were talking about podcasts without pretense. What are all the things you're working on?
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. All right. Quick rundown.
Yes, HowStuffWorks, you're busy.
HowStuffWorks Now, that's our news stuff. You should check that out. Then I also am on Brain Stuff, What the Stuff. I'm on Tech Stuff. I'm on Forward Thinking. And then I've got my goofy stuff like Podcasts Without Pretense, where I watch terrible movies, and Large Nerdron Collider, where I talk about awesome geek stuff.
With a very awesome title, I might add.
Thank you.
Where can they find all of this information? Do they just go to find you on Twitter or?
Find me on Twitter. I'm at John Strickland on Twitter, and I don't shut up about this stuff. So you'll hear all about it.
Excellent. I hope that we will. Jonathan, again, thank you so much for coming on the last, you know, two days out of the last week. Really appreciate it. It's always a lot of fun when we have you on. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Have a great night. Tomorrow's guest will be Lindsay Turrentine, an old podcasting buddy from CNET. Can't wait to chat with her about some things. I'm going to see if I can pull up some old gadgets style material. We used to do a podcast called Gadgets, and I think I can come up with some stuff for tomorrow's show for a segment. I don't know. If you have any input on that, Gadgets fans from days past, email TNT at twit.tv and send me some story links to things you might have seen in that show. I'd appreciate it. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at TNT at twit.tv. You can leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. You can also hit us up on Twitter. We are at Tech News Today TV. And, you know, just find all the ways to subscribe to our show at our place on the web. It's twit.tv/TNT. I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter, and thanks to our technical director, Josh Winich, who did a fantastic job today. Also, Greg running the words on the screen that I look at. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everyone. Oh.